Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. I have to tell you that debt is fraud. And we want to basically make sure that you, if you believe in the power of prayer, make sure you're making your appeals to heaven regarding saving the Constitution, regarding Republic review, constitutional compliance, and all the above. And your campaign started right after the election. If you want to have a successful political campaign, you have to understand the importance of public relations and having a PR campaign. Having a strong PR campaign drives the narrative, because as long as you're pointing out how the candidate, you know, the person that you, the people you're highlighting, then these guys, they're not following the Constitution. This is what they should be doing. If you do that, not just saying these guys are not following the Constitution, you have to be clear. You have to articulate how they're not following the Constitution, what they need to be doing. That right there, see, demagoguery in politics is so common that that's what we usually see out of candidates. I mean, Trump is, you know, and Obama and most of these people that rise to the top. Now, Bushes were a little bit different. They weren't necessarily demagogues, but they were managers and they managed agendas and they managed plans and so forth. They weren't leaders. But the point I'm trying to drive here is don't be a demagogue, because a demagogue only complains and, you know, put me in and we'll fix this. They don't provide a clear supply of answers, details, and what needs to happen. What a real leader does is it lays it out on the line what needs to happen. And then that way, it gives the person you're challenging an opportunity to do the right thing. But if they're hardwired that they're not going to support the Constitution, then what do? Okay? It's easy. You get rid of them, because in the upcoming election, you'll have a choice. And I believe the good people in most of these red states want people to actually support their oath of office, because all the problems we're getting are from those scoundrels, the den of thieves that are literally violating their oath of the Constitution and failing to support it. They're shredding it. So your campaign begins today. Okay. It should have began a while ago. You're behind the eight ball, but you know, I want to give you really positive messaging today. So go team. And we have Tammy with us. And so we've wrapped up going through Articles of Confederation. We've gone through the amendments to the Articles of Confederation. We covered the Annapolis report from the convention. We also covered the response from Congress in February of 87. And then we provided a compiled commissioning, or I should say the compiled delegation of power to the delegates that were going to the convention from each of the states. Now, it was clear that each of the states were talking about devising, revising, what have you, whatever they thought was necessary. And so, to be clear, remember, the word abandoned means that somebody has completely, I mean, there was a runaway convention and that these guys abandoned their commissions. Actually not. And we're going to prove this, because they were always trying, and it's so apparent in the notes that they kept on bringing up, you know, we need to make sure we're following, you know, the commissions and so forth, because they didn't want to feel like they were derailing this. And actually, so we'll get to that. But before we get to it, because as they just finished briefing the Virginia plan and then the New Jersey plan, one of the delegates, I think it was Mr. Butler? No, Miss General Pinckney. It's under Butler. General Pinckney was the one that came up with the commission comments, and he says, hey, I think we're deviating. And I want to show you how overly sensitive some of these people were, because they weren't really, but we have to look at the plans first. And I don't want to take the time to read the plans, because if we go, this is a 400-page document, folks. And so you're going to need to read along with us so you can actually see these words, so you know we're not just making it up. Plus, by reading it, it helps reinforce what needs to happen and what you need to know, what you need to understand. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, you got to do the work, right? You got to be able to actually put your finger on that trigger and pull it and, you know, hit the center of that target if that's what you're aiming at. I mean, if you're not aiming at anything, then good job. As long as you didn't hit yourself or hurt anybody, good job. Anyway, the Virginia plan was actually presented by James Madison prior to the convention. And the Virginia plan was basically accepted by the delegates that were there. Now, they did not get into the need for a Bill of Rights or anything else, because it was just talking about a plan. But the Father Groener of the Bill of Rights, the guy that made it so important that I go, unfairly, I'm labeling George Mason as a drama queen just because the way he responded, I'd rather cut off my right arm than sign that document. Wow. Are you kidding me? I mean, I'm looking at this document without the Bill of Rights and I'm going, wow, it was far stronger as a federal constitution without the Bill of Rights than with it. The only reason the Bill of Rights is important for you and I today is because it constrains the states from abusing us. There you go. And that's not because of the Bill of Rights. It's because of the 14th Amendment. And this is what kills me. And there's so many people that love enjoying and claiming, you know, we have a right to practice our religion, a right to speech. They don't have that right if it's not they don't have that right until the 14th Amendment. So bottom line, those people who say, we don't need the 14th, well, then that means you don't need your privileges and immunities either. That means that the state can actually take away your privileges and immunities. Well, no, that's not a good thing. But I hate that 14th Amendment because it's really bad. It enslaved us and it created corporations. All of the lies about the 14th Amendment just infuriate me. And this only proves to how good you and the American people have been deceived by a very ultra deceptive education system. But that being said, the Virginia plan came in as a presentation by Governor Randolph because he was the senior delegate. He jumped on the opportunity to present Madison's plan because they were pretty enthralled with it. Now, Madison's plan, basically, in a nutshell, took the Continental Congress and divided it into three separate branches, taking the magistrate and literally chopping it up so that you would have a actual judiciary, you would have an actual executive, and then you would have the sovereign part of government, which would be the legislative, which would be the representation. Now, if you really look at just that right there, just splitting up Continental Congress into a judiciary, into an executive, and into a bicameral, by the way, Madison recommended a bicameral legislative body. So it seems to me that that's very close to making adjustments. And so I'm going, okay, why would anybody have a problem with that other than the fact that it's brilliant because it creates a check and balance Because if you have all the power into one body, whether it be legislative or a person, that's where tyranny, because they have the ability to do those things. When you actually separate it, then you create a level of jealousy. Hey, I'm the president. You can't do that. Or Congress. Hey, we're Congress. You can't make that law. So these checks and balances would keep them basically, you know, in their lanes. Unfortunately, the judiciary was never this big behemoth thing that it had become today. The design of the judiciary was very passive. The design of the judiciary was that they would deal with international law, with emissaries and so forth, and treaties, all those things arising under the Constitution. You know, as a result of the Constitution, that's what the judiciary is going to do. But they didn't have the ability to necessarily reach back into what cases they wanted to hear. In other words, for them to, the Marbury v. Madison was an overreach by Marshall. And the only reason Marshall was inclined to do it was because he was trying to protect an ally in those people, in those in the judiciary under Hamilton's tutelage, that were going to be adversaries to the Constitution, or those who were going to lead the subversive charge to basically aggrandize the judiciary over the next couple of decades. And they did that with Alexander Hamilton's Federalist Papers. And so if you want to know why, I mean, most people I know do not necessarily revere anybody, right? I shouldn't say that. Most people don't look at the framers other than Washington, or, you know, they have a favorite. But Hamilton is one of those guys that, for some reason, has only been elevated in our society lately because of the progressives. And that may be because they kind of knew that he was the guy that opened the doors for where they are today. So the Virginia Plan, the unique part about it was they changed Congress. And one of the things that they wanted to empower Congress by appropriation, which was going to be by population, that there would be a set number of people that would be represented by a representative in Congress, in the House of Representatives, and that that would be based on population. So the more populated state would have more representatives. So they would not be an equality amongst the states in this Congress. The other thing that the Virginia Plan did was it created a federal government, because the states would take a diminished role, that the federal government would have all powers. Basically, they'd have full general powers. They would be able to do what was necessary. And so that went over like a lead balloon. And
that's good.
And the bicameral part, the legislature, this new House of Representatives, would then choose those senators who would serve 6 years. Representatives in the House served 2 years, and the senators who would be, in other words, the people had no choice of who those senators were going to be, but they had the choice of who their representatives would be. And in such case, they would have some level of control over the makeup and the creation of that Senate. That didn't go over very well. There was lots of problems with it. And as a matter of fact, the New Jersey Plan came back and said, you know what? We see merit in dividing the three branches, but we don't see the importance of having a bicameral legislative body. We just want legislative, and we want equality amongst the states. So in other words, it doesn't matter how many delegates you have. It basically, each state will vote by delegation. In other words, each state gets one vote. And so that, you know, was no way that there was this argument going back and forth. And so after the, after we look at the Pinckney plan, which was the New Jersey plan, I believe down the road came Roger Sherman and his plan. But I believe that actually happened after. I want to say Hamilton had a plan. I think there were like three or four plans that were presented. And so the Hamilton plan was much later on in the debates. And this goes to show how long they struggled over just the fundamental framework of the Constitution. And we're talking about nuances. Hamilton wanted to have a permanent executive, like a king. It wouldn't be heretic, or, you know, what's the term? Genetically, you know, designed that they would all be a bloodline or anything like that. But it would be a permanent king. Once chosen, it'd have to be impeached before you could choose another. And I don't know if Hamilton saw the need. I don't remember the details regarding vice president, but that was one thing that really set the hairs on the back of people's necks in the convention standing up.
Yeah.
Because
we literally just left that.
That's correct, because we just cast off this monarchy. And even though there wasn't a lot of complaints about the theocratic monarchy, right? I mean, today, when we think of a theocratic monarchy being taking over, I think most Americans would cringe. But back then, they were theocratic. The problem was that they never had the high-level conversation, because it was always when Madison, because it seemed to be this gut response, like second nature, that, oh, you know, we need to have, you know, biblical guidelines. We need to have, you know, a scriptural guide, you know, like biblically based. And we hear this today, too. But every time it came up that we need to have religious tests, we need this, we need that regarding religion, Madison would say, well, OK, so what Bible are you going to go by? And that right there silenced everybody, because now they knew they were going to get into an unwinnable, excuse the expression, pissing contest, because you only had like four or five states that were Anglican, and that was the largest body. And then the rest of them were either non-congregational, different with different doctrines, or, you know, the Puritans and so forth. So, and then there were two states that were pretty, well, they were non-denominational. That was Pennsylvania and Maryland. And then there were others, congregational. And so all states had a religious affinity, and they, you know, they were very happy with their form of a theocracy or lack thereof. And so when people started talking about the importance of the Bible and those things, then Madison basically says, okay, then we'll have to pick one, and we'll have to endow the federal government to basically enforce whatever that national religion is going to be. Is that what you want? And no. So everybody just said, okay, you know what? This will work. We can actually have multiple states with multiple theocracies, that the federal government wouldn't be able to do this. They finally came to that, but that took a long time in the debates. Now, getting to the New Jersey plan, again, they wanted a unicameral legislative body. They were okay with the dividing up of the magistrate, getting rid of a single magistrate. And so, because they kind of liked that idea, it was one of those, you know, obvious things that when it was presented, they go, wow, that's very innovative. That'll work. The one problem that they had, though, was they also wanted to have a quick turnover. And so they kind of marginalized the importance. I think maybe Randolph didn't sell it well, because we only have what Madison put in the notes, but he didn't sell very well the importance of having a Senate that, you know, would have to have this body that would be responsible for the treaties, as Randolph basically presented, that's what that body would do, and it would need to be a stable body. And so some of these ideas that Madison actually framed were maintained, but it went through major overhaul, because obviously the state legislature today was the one that prevailed, you know, in the real Constitution, in selecting their representatives, and that they would provide the suffrage of the state. Roger Sherman's compromise, which came after, I believe it came after Hamilton, Roger Sherman's compromise, or the Connecticut Compromise, basically took Madison's plan and created a parity by ensuring, and as one, so one of the things also is a bill had to pass both houses. And so having the state legislature controlling the Senate and the people controlling the House of Representatives, if there was something that would basically take away the sovereignty of the state, the Senate would stop the bill. And if there was something that was going to take the rights of the people away, the House of Representatives would stop the bill. So there was this brilliance in this one nuance and change for bicameral legislative body opened up a brand new paradigm in a Republican form of government. Now, Madison was spinning, and he was basically working with the British model that the House of Representatives was the House of Commons, that it would be elected by the people and have a two-year turnover. And that two-year turnover, if you remember, Tammy, Massachusetts wanted to maintain a re-election every year.
Right.
And that was another contention. They didn't like these long terms. And, are you kidding me? The devil incarnate's going to rise from this. And actually,
yeah, they weren't thinking about campaigning every year.
Well, so that actually came up. That was one of the things that, you know, helped refute this, because then they wouldn't be representing the people. They would constantly be running a perpetual campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in other words, they would always have their hand out. Let's give them a stable year before they put their hand out. So the Constitution had all sorts of problems. And as a matter of fact, I think one of the best books I've read that gives you a really good macro view of the Constitutional Convention and the vigor and vim that, you know, boiled over in this convention came from W. Cleon Skousen, because he actually talked, and as a matter of fact, my very first book, I cited both his 5,000-year leap as well as the Naked Communist, because the man was brilliant in seeing and analyzing things at a macro view. I'm not that good. I'm really good into the details, the analysis, strategic, and that type of stuff. But and that's why I appreciate, you know, textbooks kind of like W. Cleon Skousen's. Now, when we look at what it took to move forward, the real problem that basically, I mean, these men were working, and because they couldn't even get over some of the nuances, I'm telling you, folks, if you think we're divided today, they're equally divided back in those days. And it wasn't until Benjamin Franklin called upon the committee to go pray, that we needed to pray at the beginning of every day, you know, before we met, so that we would have his, we'd invite his spirit, because I believe he said something that even our creator would notice even the smallest sparrow falling from the skies. How do we believe that we can build the greatest empire without his help? Mm-hmm. And so they basically went off and they made that, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, every session starts with a prayer. I mean, you know, wow, they take one day out of the two-year time frame to have an opening, you know, an invocation. But anyway, as these things kept on going, and as a matter of fact, after the Pinckney plan, after the New Jersey plan, they were discussing, again, when we look at what they were talking about doing, they hadn't even really started transposing those components and those things that were in the Articles of Confederation into the Constitution yet. They hadn't even started that. But what they were starting was this framework. And the framework was Republican in form, because you can see the legislative body was the representatives of the people by both of the plans, by both the Virginia plan and the New Jersey plan. And so what we're going to dive into when we come back, I'm going to have Tammy read a couple of concerns regarding the commissions that these men felt that they were serving, because we want to make sure that these guys didn't abandon, and we want to prove this. So we'll be right back after this promo. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so welcome back. And as I was saying, when we come back, we were going to talk about these commissions. And I want, because one of the very first things that really jumps out is how these men were very, they wanted to make sure that they were doing what was expected of them. Now, if there was language throughout the convention, hey, you know what, this is a great idea. I don't know if we're going to get away with it, but, you know, who cares? We're doing something that, you know, we all agree is the best thing to do. We don't care about that commission. There's no language like that at all. And so one of the things that we want to point out is it was General Pinckney. Now, Pinckney was, again, from New Jersey. So, Tammy, I'm not sure if you're muted, but if you're ready to start, let's start with Wednesday the 30th, folks. We're starting on Wednesday the 30th. And hold on here. No, we're not. We're not starting there. I actually went down to the wrong spot. No, we are. And it is Mr. Butler, and it's the commission. Yes, Wednesday the 30th.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
So this is General Pinckney. Expressed a doubt whether the act of Congress recommending the convention or the commission of the deputies to it could authorize a discussion of the system founded on different principles from the federal constitution.
Keep going. Okay. So Mr. Gary
seemed to entertain the same doubt.
Now, he's from Massachusetts, Eldridge Gary. Governor Morris, go ahead.
Mr. Governor Morris explained the distinction between the federal and national supreme government, the former being a mere compact resting on the good faith of the parties, the latter having a complete and compulsive operation. He contended that in all the communities there must be one supreme power and one only.
Okay, so right here, this goes to the idea of creating a supreme general power, right? So this is interesting because in those days, they looked at a federal as a mere government that was resting on the good faith of the parties with, you know, few powers. The latter being the national, you know, having complete and compulsive operation. So the real question was, in their eyes, were they creating a federal or that type of a general government or a national general government? Now, today, when we look at a confederation, we look at a confederation's general government as just that, a general government. But back in those days, they referred to it as a federal. Now, today, a federation, instead of a confederation, they would have a federal government and federalism. And most people think that federalism is a concept of limited powers, but it actually isn't, based on a federation. In other words, were they looking at converting the confederation into a federation? And actually, Madison's plan was creating a federation, that they would actually create these compulsive powers. However, They only had compulsive powers for taxing for those things delegated. In other words, you have to give them the ability to collect the money they need to do those few things that they need to do. And ergo, we, you know, see that they actually maintained the confederation. They didn't create a federation where they had unabridged powers. They had, you know, unvarnished powers to do whatever they wanted to do to us. So go ahead and let's now go with Mason, because we're going to cover this for a little while, okay?
Mr. Mason observed that the present confederation was not only deficient in not providing for coercion and punishment against delinquent states, but argued very cogently that punishment could not, in the nature of things, be executed on the states collectively, and therefore that such government was necessary as could directly operate on individuals and would punish those only whose guilt required it.
Okay, then Mr. Sherman of... Now, Mason is from Virginia. Now, here's a big state saying we need to have these powers. Mr. Sherman.
Who took his seat. Mr. Sherman, who took his seat today, admitted
okay, so
that
what,
the Confederation...
I'm sorry. Let me add to this. Sometimes you're going to see these little comments. Mr. Sherman took his seat today. This means that he finally arrived. Now, remember, Connecticut didn't do their commission until very late. Right. And so, voila, the 30th of May, he shows up. If you actually look at the very top with a glance, you'll see that they started May 14th but did nothing. They actually went over a week. Right? That to me, to the 25th, that's 11 days. They waited 11 days before they felt like they had quorum to be able to start. So they were already under this anxiety that the states weren't taking this seriously. Okay, so Mr. Sherman finally took his seat today. This is Madison's little, you know, okay, I'm making this note. That's when he showed up. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. So Mr. Sherman admitted that the Confederation had not given sufficient power to Congress and that additional powers were necessary, particularly that of raising money, which he said would involve many other powers. He admitted also that the general and particular jurisdictions ought in no case to be concurrent. He seemed, however, not be disposed to make too great inroads on the existing system, intimating as one reason that it would be wrong to lose every amendment by inserting such as would not be agreed to by the states.
Okay. It was moved by Mr. Reed. Now, this is a function of the committee. So it was moved by Mr. Reed and seconded by Mr. Coatsworth Pinckney to postpone the third proposition last offered by Randolph, viz., that a national government ought to be established consisting of a supreme legislative, executive, and judiciary in order to take up the following, viz., quote, resolved that in order to carry into execution the design of the states in forming this convention and to accomplish the objects proposed by the Confederation, a more effective government consisting of a legislature, executive, and judiciary ought to be established. And so so they're diving into, because they want to go back and they want to make sure that they're addressing what they think is important. And so they're actually maintaining, it's kind of like they ride this bike throughout most of the convention with their, you know, what do they call those? Training wheels. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Because they're very cautious that they're going to create a plan. And actually down the road, they start realizing that, you know, this is really coming together. And they realize that there's not one state legislature that's going to allow this. There's no way that they could get even a good majority because they knew six states that were enjoying their power. If they gave it to the state legislatures, they would actually reject the Constitution, which is why they changed the manner of ratification to have delegations of the people ratified. Now, what I just said is that delegations, the people chose their delegates to go and ratify the convention. the names that you find in the ratification debates are the, you know, the names of the day of the political class. In other words, it wasn't Billy Bob and Mrs. Smith, you know, and Mrs., you know, Winfield. Oh, yeah. These were the minds of the day that understood politics.
Mm-hmm.
And so most people want to say, well, no, the people debated this. No, they didn't. They actually, there was a large trust in these men that carried them through the revolution and carried them to this point. And in some ways, some of the people didn't see all of the problems. You know, if you lived up in Massachusetts with the Shea Rebellion, they kind of saw that. And some people were feeling the problems and the effects of inflation of the currencies. But there were lots of people that didn't even dabble with money or anything else because they were just living and sustaining themselves off of, you know, off of the land. There were quite a few people in America that were just, they didn't buy the paper, they weren't literate, and they were living off the land, and they were happy. So, So it was, you know, whether there was a lot of people involved, because I think most people do know that the revolution was conducted and executed by somewhere between 3 to 7% of the people of America.
Right.
In other words, it was a very small class, subclass, and many of them were leaders who became officers, and those officers had enlisted because these people, you know, had at least some enough of I'll just say involvement in the day-to-day affairs with government that they understood the importance because they didn't like the, you know, the stamp taxes and so forth. So anyway, all right. So the motion to postpone for the purpose was lost. In other words, they couldn't, you know, actually fulfill the motion that Mr. Reed put forward, and they give you the yeas and nays. And I think I love this, the fact that you can actually see the outcomes. And then it goes on, so it goes back and forth, and then Mr. Madison observes. So go ahead.
Mr. Madison, observing that the words, or to the number of free inhabitants, might occasion debate, which would divert the committee from the general question whether the principle of representation should be changed, moved that they might be struck out.
Okay, so... And obviously, Mr. Madison is writing these notes. And so you're going to see a little bit of bias in some, every once in a while it'll shine through. But for the most part, I think he did a really good job of maintaining objectivity. But go ahead, Mr. King.
Mr. King observed that the quotes, that the quotas of contribution, which would alone remain as the measure of representation, would not answer because waiving every other view of the matter, revenue might hereafter be so collected by the general government that the sums respectively drawn from the states would not appear and would besides be continually varying.
Okay. Madison.
Mr. Madison admitted the propriety of the observation and that some better rule ought to be found.
And Mr. Hamilton comes up. There you go.
So Colonel Hamilton moved to alter the resolution so as to read that the rights of suffrage in the national legislature ought to be proportioned to the number of free inhabitants. Mr. Spate seconded the motion. It was then moved that the resolution be postponed. Phone, which is agreed to.
Okay, so then Mr. Randolph and Mr. Madison.
Then moved the following resolution that the rights of suffrage in the national legislature ought to be proportioned. It was moved and seconded to amend it by adding, and not according to the present system, which was agreed to. It was then moved and seconded to alter the resolution so as to read that the rights of suffrage in the national legislature ought not to be according to the present system. It was then moved and seconded to postpone the resolution moved by Mr. Randolph and Mr. Madison, which being agreed to.
Okay. All right. So we go down and go ahead because we're going to read Mr. Madison and then Mr. Reed because, again, they're going to, because they haven't gone very far, but they're agreeing to actually, you know, because they're changing apportionment doesn't mean that they've changed principles. It just means that they're trying to create a system more representative and less, I'll just say binary, or it's not really binary. It is heterogeneous, where every part has, its sovereignty and an equality among the parts. So go ahead and read Mr. Madison, and then go ahead and read the next few comments here.
Okay. Mr. Madison moved, in order to get over the difficulties, the following resolution: that the equality of suffrage established by the Articles of Confederation ought not to prevail in the national legislature, and that an equitable ratio of representation ought to be substituted. This was seconded by Mr. Governor Morris, and being generally relished, would have been agreed to when
Mr. Reed
moved that the whole clause relating to the point of representation be postponed, reminding the committee that the deputies from Delaware were restrained by their commission from asserting to any change of the rule of suffrage, and in case such a change should be fixed on, it might become their duty to retire from the convention.
Okay, so what you have is a clarity that these guys with the constraints, which was Massachusetts and Delaware, these guys were said that we have to maintain equal suffrage. And that was seconded in, I think it was Massachusetts, along with, I think, the unanimity. They wanted to make sure that they maintained 100% agreement, which that went out the window because that was the real problem, and everybody in the room admitted it. They had to throw out that. They had to actually come up with a better system, which three-fourths was. So, did it seem like these guys were insensitive in abandoning their commission? Did Delaware leave the committee? In other words, when you look at the Constitution, did Delaware not sign it? They sure did. They were there for the entire thing. It's just that it took time to develop a system that gave them that equal suffrage in one house, but not in the other. And by balancing it from representatives of the people to representatives of the state legislature. And that right there maintained the spirit or principle that these two states were constrained by. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So we can go on and on and on. But actually, one of the things that actually comes up and it gets discussed quite a bit is the electors. And so if you go down to May 31st, Mr. Sherman, Mr. Gary, Mr. Mason, and then Mr. Wilson speak, and then Mr. Madison speaks about the electors, or actually I think it's Mr. Wilson, yeah. So Mr. Wilson speaks about the electors, and they start talking about the electors themselves. So, and as a matter of fact, I would think, and I believe in the original system, the electors had a little bit larger role than just choosing the president. But I believe that there's no reason why we can't use electors in the state to actually choose our governor. Why are we not doing that instead of having popular vote? Because if we actually choose electors, there's a good likelihood that the population center wouldn't be able to drive, you know, their residents into the governor's mansion. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So let's go ahead. Mr. Wilson and the electors.
Okay. Contended strenuously for drawing the most numerous branch of the legislature immediately from the people. He was for raising the federal pyramid to a considerable altitude, and for the reason wished to give it as broad a basis as possible. No government could long subsist without the confidence of the people. In a Republican government, this confidence was particularly essential. He also thought it wrong to increase the weight of the state legislatures by making them the electors of the national legislature. All interference between the general and local governments should be obviated as much as possible. On examination, it would be found that the opposition of states to federal measures have proceeded much more from the officers of the states than from the people at large.
Okay. So, Madison then makes this, in talking about the electors, go ahead.
Mr. Madison considered the popular election of one branch of the national legislature as essential to every plan of free government. He observed that in some of the states, one branch of the legislature was composed of men already removed from the people by an intervening body of electors. That if the first branch of the general legislature should be elected by the state legislators, the second branch elected by the first, the executive by the second together with the first, and other appointments again made for subordinate purposes for the executive, the people would be lost sight of altogether, and the necessary sympathy between them and their rulers and officers too little felt. He was an advocate for the policy of refining the popular appointments by successive filtrations, but thought it might be pushed too far. He wished the expedient to be resorted to only in the appointment of the second branch of the legislature and in the executive and judiciary branches of the government. He thought, too, that the great fabric to be raised would be more stable and durable if it should rest on the solid foundation of the people themselves than if it should stand merely on the pillars of the legislatures.
Okay, so this he's kind of lending to, and I would defy anybody to read that one time through and say, what did he just say? What he really is lending to is that these electors who would be chosen by the people, because that's what he's saying. He's saying at the very end here, if it should rest on the solid foundation of the people themselves, then if it should stand merely on the pillars of the legislature. In other words, and I think in his original plan, the legislatures were the ones that were going to select. No. I think that may have been the Pinckney plan, or did we cover a different plan already? No, at that point, we had already only covered the two plans. And so I think that one of the changes in the Pinckney plan was that the people wouldn't select their representatives, the state legislature would. And that's why Madison wanted to go back to and said, I think we need to select electors, and that the people would select those electors to actually do that. But they ended up keeping the electors for choosing the president. In other words, in their day, they recognized the wisdom of the sages in their class, or I should say, in their midst. A sage is that wise person that has been involved in the politics and the ins and outs and so forth, but is of an age where they don't desire to do that anymore because it's strenuous work to travel, you know, to go and, you know, travel at large and so forth. And so, you know, they retire, right? And the electors would be sages because they would understand the temperament, you know, education, and those types of things needed to actually choose a better representative, a better president, whatever they would be choosing. Give it to these wise people. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Today, it's just, oh, you know, we want to, like, people brag about having, and as a matter of fact, I was at a Republican convention, and they were bragging about actually choosing an 18-year-old elector for president.
Yeah.
And what is the age requirements for an elector? What are the constitutional requirements for an elector of president?
30?
25, and must be a citizen of 7 years. Those are the only requirements for being a representative and an elector. But they were bragging because they choose the stupid kid out of high school just because he fell into a demographic that, oh, doesn't that make you feel warm that they chose that kid? I don't want to get into some of that stuff before, but I'm just saying, people, you know, they have no idea what they're doing. I mean, we used to have 21 as a voting age, and I thought that was probably the best thing. because when I was 18 and I went to vote, I'll have to admit that I was charged by the education system, you know, and all invigorated to do the stupid stuff that I did. I voted Democrat my very first election because they were basically charging us up to do that. I mean, come on. What would you expect that institution to be doing? Oh, we want you to rationally think and, you know, and here's a process of, you know, doing a, you know, a comparison, a contrast and comparison so that you could choose literally the best candidate. No, no, no. Go choose our candidate.
Anyway. I did not. I voted Republican.
Okay. Well, that's good. Did you vote at 18 or did you vote? Did you vote when you were
18? I did. I don't think I voted at 18.
Okay. And that's so I had the opportunity to vote at age 18. But when I became a Marine a couple years later, because I actually didn't vote after that. I mean, I didn't even care. But when I became a Marine, I registered to vote, and I had been voting ever since. And I started voting just Republican, and then I realized, you know, that's not helping. We've got to try to vote for the best candidate. And unfortunately, the reality is that you're not going to find the best candidate because they can't make it through the primaries. Because the parties scuttled some of the best candidates. I mean, I remember in 2018, the governor's race for Wyoming. I thought Taylor Haynes, I still to this day believe Taylor Haynes would have been the best thing for Wyoming.
That's who I voted for, or would have voted for, yeah.
But Harriet Hageman, I just didn't think was there. She was a lawyer. She always wanted to defer to the courts. And I think that over time, she's heard enough criticism about her tendencies to lean on the bench and the courts that she's kind of changed her tune a little bit. But it's hard for a leopard to change their spots, right? Because she's a lawyer. Taylor Haynes being a doctor, I mean, he had a completely different paradigm. I would love to see Taylor Haynes run again. But, you know, and then you've got... Let me just say this without even mentioning names. Whenever I find an officer, a military officer in politics, I shrug. I get scared because the military paradigm is an autocratic paradigm. These guys believe that they're in charge. They can do anything and everything. And I remember in the 2018 election, Rex Rammel, I think, was one of those guys that was an autocrat. I had the conversation. I think I even interviewed him where we talked, and we're going to run out of time right now. We were going into these last throws. I remember talking to him. He says, I'm going to do it because I'm governor and I'm going to use executive orders, whatever I need to do. We're going to get this done.
Yeah, I remember him saying that.
Yeah, okay. So, well, we'll have Tammy back. We could talk a little bit more about that, but when we come back, we'll be diving more into Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. And we don't have any per se content, so we're going to do my best. I'll do my best to try to let you know what we talked about. But you got to know, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.